behavioural biologist Professor Lloyd Spencer Davis has been studying penguins for some 3 decades now, and he has written reams of learned papers and several books about them. His latest is a kind of scientific memoir, Professor Penguin it's called, and it describes how he became involved with penguins, what he's learned about them, and some of the many scientists he's worked with over the years, all in a highly entertaining way, as befits someone who teaches creative non-fiction writing at the University of Otago, where he holds the Stewart Chair in Science Communication. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, Kim. Thank you for the lovely introduction.
Plus photos, nice photos, good pictures.
Oh, thank you.
You give a profile of George Murray Levick in the book, the first to really study penguin behaviour from 1911 at Cape Adare in Antarctica. And I heard the other day that one of his notebooks has been found in Scott's hut when the ice melted and is now being conserved. Did you hear about that?
I hadn't heard that particular story.
Not a very interesting notebook, apparently. It's all about, you know, camera angles.
Yes. When I was researching this book, which was last year, I had the privilege of going to the Scott Polar Research Institute and actually getting access to Levick's notebooks and diaries, including the ones that he kept when he was living in a snow cave for 6 months.
His descriptions were censored when he first brought them out of Penguin Behaviour because of the depravity he witnessed and wrote down.
Yes, that's a really interesting story, actually, yeah. Because he was the first penguin biologist, in a sense, and certainly the first penguin biologist to produce a really decent book about them. And it reads like a sort of, I don't know, it's fairly anthropomorphic, and it seems kind of mundane in a way. But then in 2012, it was discovered that he had produced a manuscript about the mating and sexual behaviour of the penguins that had been not allowed to be published by the British Museum of Natural History. And instead, they'd made 100 copies and distributed them internally. And in that, he described all sorts of sexual depravities, which penguins, as it turns out, are capable of exhibiting.
Autoeroticism, rape, homosexual behaviour and other peccadilloes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Peccadilloes. and in fact, you elaborate on this. You've explored the shocking truth about penguin sex lives before promiscuous sex, adultery, prostitution. Elaborate on the prostitution, please.
Well, it's interesting because
call me shallow for going straight to the sex, but never mind. Let's get it over.
I know. I didn't expect this.
No,
Kim.
I'm sorry.
I wanted to work up to it because prostitution is actually kind of it's one of those words that causes people to say, oh, you shouldn't say that about animals.
How can anthropomorphism.
Anthropomorphism, just exaggerating and so forth. But the reality is that penguins use stones. In the Antarctic, these are daily penguins that we've been studying, use stones to line the inside of their nests so that they can keep the eggs free of snow melt. When the snow melts, the eggs stay out of the water. And as a consequence, males particularly will go and collect a whole lot of stones and make nests. And these are hopefully attractive to females that will mate with them. And there are slightly more males than there are females. So there's always a sort of number of males hanging on the outside of these little subcolonies that have nothing to do but go and get stones because they haven't got any partners at that point. And they collect what seems like a major sort of castle of rocks, but without a partner. And what happens when a pair of penguins have completed mating is that the female will set about shoring up the nest, and then they lay 2 eggs. So she lays 1 egg, and then the male will start incubating, and the female will go and collect some stones herself. And quite often she can steal them from neighbors' nests, or she can go and get them from the outside of the colony and so forth. But some females have learnt that if they go up to these males that are unpaired and act like they want to have sex with them, the males are so desperate that they'll sort of stand out of the way and the female can grab a stone and go back to her own nest. And that all seems like a fairly duplicitous but, you know, clever way of collecting stones if you're that way inclined. But in a few cases we observed, and when I say a few, it was quite a few, that the females will actually come up to the males, act like they're going to have sex, and the males will then move off the nest, and the female will actually lie down in the nest, have sex with the male, and then pick up the stone and take it back to her nest and her actual mate.
And sometimes they'll do this more than once to the same guy.
They can do it up to 20 times, yeah.
To the same guy.
To the same guy,
desperate,
yeah.
And we're stupid.
Desperate, slow learners, yeah.
Goodness me. You talk about something called obligate, while we're on the subject of eggs, obligate brood reduction. This is in erect crested penguins on the Antipodes Island, as far as I know, the only ones. They lay two eggs. The second one is always the biggest, and the second one is the only one to survive. Please explain why this would happen.
Well, that's a good question. If I really knew the answer to that, then it would be a much bigger book and a much more academic book, perhaps.
Do they both hatch out, and the chick from the smallest egg always dies, or do they not both hatch out?
Well, good question. There are six species of these crested penguins, and three of them, the chicks from the smaller first egg will hatch out. But will eventually die. The one from the first egg,
inevitably,
almost inevitably. There are a few cases in things like rockhopper penguins and things like that where you may occasionally get both chicks surviving, but it's very, very rare. Now, in the case of the erect crested penguins and the royal penguins and macaroni penguins, they very, very seldom get a chick even hatching from the first egg, because the first egg is lost before it ever gets to the point where it could hatch. But we know from if we take the eggs and we translocate them and put them with other females, or we remove the bigger second egg, that the chick inside the embryo is perfectly viable and will hatch if you keep it.
So what, an insurance policy, do you think?
Well, that was part of the argument. That was the academic argument that, yes, it's insurance, so that you can only really rear one chick. And this comes about because they have to go a long way offshore to get their food. And you can't really bring back enough food to provision two chicks. But if you lose one of your eggs, then you've lost your reproductive potential for that year. So it seemed like, you know, having another egg there was kind of like insurance. But the difficulty with that argument is, in the case of erect crested penguins and royal penguins and macaroni penguins, which have this extreme egg size dimorphism or difference in egg sizes, is that they typically lose that first egg by the time that they even lay the second egg. So, you know, it would be like having an insurance policy and then just ripping it up.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Maybe it's something
very weird.
Is it some kind of warm-up procedure to get the hormones working properly for the second egg? What do you think?
Yes, I think that's...
By George, I think she's got it!
Eureka!
It was nothing.
Thank you for that. We're going to start research on it straight away.
I know.
It honestly could be something like that. That if you think about it, if there's some advantage to why the second egg should be more advantageous to you than the first egg, and there are ways that you can think of that happening. Like we know that there's a lot of fighting goes on and things like that in the colony before they start to lay the eggs, and when they just started laying the eggs. And so there might be an advantage in the second egg, but you can't have a second egg without also having a first egg. And all they can really do in an evolutionary sense is actually reduce the size of the first egg. Whereas if there was an advantage to the having a first egg, say, and you were laying two eggs at that point, you could just simply drop off having the second egg. So that is one of the, if you like, one of the theories that has been put forward to explain this weird form of breeding. But in all truthfulness, we really don't know the answer to this question.
It's quite nice then that there are still things that one doesn't know about penguins.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think it will continue to be that way. When I began my work on penguins way back in 1977, even then people were saying, what can you possibly learn about penguins? Surely everyone knows everything there is to know about penguins then. And really, we were hardly scratching the surface.
As we said, George Murray Levick was at Cape Adare. Cape Adare is the world's largest Adélie penguin colony. You went to Cape Bird in Antarctica. Why? Why Cape Bird?
Well, I was at the time, I was a student at the University of Canterbury, and that's where the University of Canterbury had a base. And in actual fact, I initially wanted to go and work on Weddell seals, but my proposal wasn't met with a great deal of enthusiasm. And so I had to change at the last minute to a different project, and that was when I started thinking about penguins.
What did you want to do with Weddell seals?
Well, I wanted to study their behaviour initially, and I was working with a guy called Malcolm Crawley, who was a lecturer at the University of Canterbury, but he'd been down to the Antarctica a while earlier, and in the meantime the Americans had done all the work that he had recommended that I do on the behaviour of Weddell seals on land. So I had reasoned that I should study their behaviour underwater, and unfortunately my proposal to dive with Weddell seals and study them underwater didn't meet with any great enthusiasm. Maybe fortunate in the long run, actually.
Yeah, well, as it turns out, I suppose, because penguins are terribly prepossessing, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I really hadn't had any prior sort of inclination to be involved with penguins at all. But once you do encounter a penguin and you do, meet with it, come to terms with it, you're smitten. You can't help it.
I'll have to say this, just say it, you know, because there's no way around it, but I ran it past Tony Blakely in the last hour just to make sure that not everybody except me knew this. Penguins don't have penises.
Well, they have a kind of, they don't have a thing that we call a penis. They have a cloaca, and it's an organ that the male and female have that transmits the sexual gametes, the sperm or the eggs and so forth.
It's pretty random.
It's not random at all. I mean, it's just what birds do.
I think they might have penises?
Well, I wouldn't like to
say
that.
I know
I'm
you
not
wouldn't.
Your therapist.
No, no. No, but the thing is, no birds have penises, right?
That's right. Yeah,
so
they have a cloaca.
So the sheer idea that I would ever have dreamt that penguins have penises goes to the fact that there they are walking around like little gentlemen. That's the thing in my head, isn't it?
Oh, because they look like little gentlemen,
yes,
with their tuxedos on.
Yes.
Yeah. But you see, one of the interesting things about birds was that, you know, they had to fly. And so a lot of the sort of genitalia that would normally be associated, say, with a male or something like that, a male mammal or something, you wouldn't want to have, you know, dangling around. It wouldn't be very aerodynamic if you were a flying bird. And as a consequence, birds have very tiny testicles that are internal, and they only ever really sort of expand during the breeding season when they increase in size.
You talk about banding the penguins.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? You put bands around their
flippery
wings.
They're flippery wings, that's good. They're wingy flippers.
Yeah.
The bands we use down there are sort of an aluminium alloy, and they wrap around like a little bangle, I guess, except they're quite tight fitting. It's very important that you get them exactly right on the flipper when you put it on.
But you also say how shocked French scientist Yvonne Lemao was about the disruption caused by this flipper banding, and presumably it also affects their swimming.
Yes, and in fact, Yvonne was one of the first to use these sort of RFID tags, the sort of tags that when you go to the vet now, your dog has to have implanted in, as a way of identifying the dog.
Microchip.
We'll call it a microchip. Yeah. The thing is that they're useful for identifying an animal if you know that that's the animal you want to identify. The problem with doing any kind of population studies is that you need to have some external marker so you can tell that that's a bird that you've got marked. And there really is no substitute for a band as such. However, it is true that some of the studies have shown that by simply putting a band on a penguin, you can alter the sort of drag and the amount of energy that the penguin needs to expend, that you increase the time it needs to spend foraging, and over a long period of time, in some studies, you even increase the mortality associated with having the band on there.
So other studies, how do you feel about this?
A little drawn. I mean, I think the point is that if you're going to do any kind of population studies, you do need an effective external marker. And I think what we need to do is find effective bands. It's not that banding, there's not anything inherently wrong with banding. It's making sure that you find the right bands and that you apply them correctly. And for example, Dee Boersma has been working on Magellanic penguins in Argentina for...
Magellanic, is that how you say that?
Well, that's Magellanic. How I say it.
No, that's good. I've been saying it wrong my whole life.
Well, I probably have too, and we should both probably be corrected.
Yeah,
that's how she says it. She says Magellanic, and if it's good enough for Dee, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have no credibility left anyway, given the penguin penis thing. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm not gonna hold that against you, though.
Thank you.
The thing is that Dee's study of the Magellanic penguins showed that by banding them, and she's been banding for something like 25 years, that there was no effect on their mortality. There was no negative effect of banding. So certain types of bands on certain types of penguins can be absolutely okay, and it's just making sure that we get the right sort of bands. There's quite a lot of research being done now on using a sort of plastic bands that expand with the penguins and as they go through molt and things like that.
The big thing, of course, was learning what they did at sea, because, you know, they are best at sea. They're kind of clumsy on land, and they have all sorts of problems, but at sea, presumably, that's where they belong. How did you figure out what they were doing and how far they can swim?
Yes, that's the interesting thing, that when people like George Murray Levick and that were studying penguins, the early penguin biologists, they only studied the birds they could see, which was obviously the birds when they're out of the water breeding. But penguins are actually seabirds. They've evolved to live in the sea. They're flightless. They dive down to get their food, and they're supremely well designed. I mean, just absolutely beautifully designed, to the point where their coefficients of drag are lower than anything that humans can design or invent ourselves. And it's only really with the invention of tiny little computer chips that we're able to now follow penguins at sea and monitor their behavior, their diving behavior. We can put little loggers on that record the depth that they go to. We've been able to use initially radio transmitters, then satellite transmitters, and then subsequently GPS loggers that allow us to track where penguins are at sea. And from that, we're really gaining a huge amount of information about what it is that penguins do when they're out there. And from that also, learning about the marine environment, because in a sense they can be sentinels for how healthy the marine environment is.
Why are there no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, I think the simple answer is there are not, because they evolved in the Southern Hemisphere. And what penguins require is a highly concentrated source of food, schooling fish or swarms of krill, and they need this high energy food to sustain their high energy lifestyle, which is they have to take an enormous amount of effort to go out to sea, get the food, and then bring it back. And the problem for penguins is that the tropical waters are pretty much like a desert. Yes, that you get coral reefs where there's quite a lot of, you know, fancy fish all around there. But the great open swathes of water in the tropics are fairly depleted of the sort of life that would be needed to sustain penguins. And it's only in places like the Galapagos Islands and Peru where you get the upwelling from the Humboldt Current, which is actually bringing all the nutrients from the south polar regions, that you can actually get penguins living even on the equator like you do. But there just isn't the food to sustain them going north. Whereas I'm sure that if you could transport penguins to, for example, the Arctic, they would be absolutely fine on sense.
That's what I was thinking. Why?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it'll come to that.
Well, there's another problem for them, though, and that, you know, penguins are flightless, and that makes them, and yet they have to, because they're birds, they have to lay their eggs on land.
Polar bears,
wolverines, you've got it in one. They're vulnerable to predators, and that was the thing about the southern areas. Until, you know, humans came along and brought cats and foxes and whatever else, there were no real land-based mammals that they had to contend with, and so that was another reason why penguins evolved where they did. I think they, you know, I mean, I'm sure that if you took penguins up to the Arctic region, they would do well in some circumstances.
What's the pulse of the health of the penguin population, as it were, given climate change, given oceanic depredations? How are penguins going? 17 species, I think.
Yes, the number of species is a little bit in doubt because of all the genetics going on and things like that. But overall, penguins are not doing terribly well. There are some penguins that are maintaining their populations, but the vast majority are either threatened or at some form of risk. And this mainly comes about through things like climate change, through pollution, through the threat of oil, through oil pollution, oil discharge, guano harvesting, things like that. Humans have not been terribly good for penguins.
The hormonal issue is something that we broached earlier. And you say that the survival of the penguin is really an issue of timing. And to illustrate that, you talk about, you know, the female lays the eggs, the male sits on the eggs, or the eggs hatch, the female's still not back. Does the male leave the eggs or leave the chicks and save himself? Or does he stay and die? And in fact, he leaves and saves himself, you know, as you probably would. And penguin colonies are littered with broken eggs and dead chicks. Is that just nature raw in tooth and what's it? Or is it some kind of wrong thing that needs to be remedied? Do you know what I mean? If this happened to people, we'd be going, we've got to stop this. This is terrible. We need systems in place to make sure that blah, blah, blah. But we watch the penguins abandon their eggs and abandon their chicks and think, oh, well, that's all right then.
Yes, but I think what the penguins have is that they have a mechanism that says, okay, we'll do what we can, but what really is important is the long-term reproductive success for individuals. And to go back a little bit and just explain, penguins, because they feed at sea and breed on land, have this dilemma that they've got to get their food at sea, but when they're on land, they can't eat. So they're on a diet. When they're rearing their offspring and they're on land looking after them, they're basically fasting. And you can only fast for so long. How long you can fast depends on how much fat you have. And they use up the fat just sitting there, even just incubating or brooding the chicks. And so there's a limit to how long they can be there. And if the partner at sea, one partner is out at sea feeding while the one is on the nest, if that partner hasn't got back in time, then the bird on the nest has to make a decision. Do I hang in here?
A little bit longer, a little bit longer.
A little bit longer. And the problem is, And this is the thing that's so marvelous about evolution, is that they have a little mechanism so that once their fat reserves are used up about 80%, they start burning protein. And protein they get by breaking down their muscles. And this sends a signal to their head which says, hey, you've got to get out of here. You've got to get some food. Because the thing is that once you start breaking down the muscles, these are the very things that enable you to move. These are the very things that enable you to get food. And you're going to be dead if you don't take heed of that. And so there's no point being a dead bird, lying on the nest with your eggs there. You're better to go off, kiss that season's reproductive success goodbye.
And live to mate another day.
Live to mate another day. Yeah, I wish I'd used that line myself.
Live to mate another day. It's my line. Emperor penguins, if the mother is laid back and the male has the chicks, another astonishing fact from your book, the emperor penguins can make a kind of a sustenance for the chicks to keep them going, pending the mother's regurgitating fish for them. What is that?
Well, this is the emperor penguins really have the most remarkable breeding system, I'd say, any animal. They breed during the Antarctic winter, and the males actually look after the egg the entire incubation period, which is somewhat like a bit over 2 months. And not only that, the males have spent about 6 weeks prior to that fasting because they've been getting to the colony and then going through the process of courtship.
120 days they can fast for.
Yes, it's absolutely incredible. Now, the thing is that when the chick hatches, and emperor penguins only lay a single egg, which the male carries on his feet, when the chick hatches, it has the little remnants of the yolk sac that was in the egg there that gives the chick maybe about 5 or 6 days leeway that the mother hasn't got back. They can still sustain itself. However, after that, then the chick is dead. Now, the thing is that the females need to get back to the colony before the chick really gets to that desperate stage. However, sometimes, conditions or things get in the way, the female hasn't been able to find enough food, whatever. And so as an extra insurance policy, and I just find it absolutely fascinating, this male that has been fasting for 120 days, as you say, can actually form a kind of milk by breaking down his own body materials. So he actually produces a milk for the chick. He can't produce much, but again, it's just an emergency sort of filler, just to give the chick a little bit of leeway in case the mother is a bit late getting back.
Good Lord. Are you writing, did I read, a biography of Henry David Thoreau next? Did I read that?
I don't know where you read that, and I'm not writing a biography of him so much, but I am working on a project about him, yes.
That's very mysterious, Lloyd. What sort of a project?
Thoreau has been very influential to me. He's probably the natural history writer who really resonated with me the most when I was younger. And I've been working just in the background on a sort of project about what I call nature's voices. People who are advocates of nature, people like Thoreau, Rachel Carson, Walt Whitman, photographers like Ansel Adams, and how they've affected the psyche of the people in relation to how we relate to nature.
Interesting. Thank you. More to say, out of time. Lloyd Spencer Davis, Professor Penguin is the name of his book, Discovery and Adventure with Penguins. Thank you very much, Lloyd.